Although the characters we discuss are fictional, the challenges people face every day are not. The information we provide in this podcast is for entertainment and informational purposes only and should not be used in place of advice from a mental health or medical professional. If you are struggling with mental health issues, please seek professional help. Thanks for listening and welcome to the Jedi Council Podcast, where we explore mental health in your favorite fictional characters. Hey folks, welcome back to the next episode of the Jedi Council Podcast. This is your co-host Brandon Saxton.
And Katie Gordon.
How are you doing today, Katie?
I'm doing well, how are you?
I'm doing really good, and one interesting fun fact about Fargo is that summer happened today. In that last week it was like 60s and 50s and rainy, and today I think it was 94 when I was driving home from work, so it's summer.
It is, yeah. And I actually think, wasn't it in the 60s this morning?
I think it was, yeah, actually pretty substantial.
I left work and things had changed a lot. That's your Fargo weather report,
yep,
for our listeners.
That's our regular segment. No,
which is always a week or two out of date, depending on when we upload the episode.
Absolutely.
We're very excited today to have a special guest on. Dr. Chris Martin is currently a postdoctoral fellow in social science, and he's done a lot of interesting research and other work. Today, we asked him on specifically to talk about a college class that he teaches on happiness, but we'll also save some time at the end to talk about his podcast, Half Hour of Heterodoxy, and his stand-up comedy, too. How are you doing today, Chris?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Super excited about it. So maybe before we get into your happiness class, can you tell us about what got you interested in social psychology and positive psychology?
Well, when I was a high school student, I was interested in philosophy and religion, and I felt like they had answers to the deeper questions in life. And the more I thought about them, the more I realized that the lack of empiricism was a problem, at least for me. And I started to feel like psychology maybe had answers that were more meaningful. And so I started to read more about psychology. I didn't have a lot of options at the time, so I was really reading some pretty crappy self-help books mostly, but they were interesting. I thought about becoming a psychiatrist for a while, and then I realized that meant going to med school, and I was too lazy to do med school. So I decided to major in psychology, and I took Intro to Psych. I wasn't sure which subfield of psych I was most interested in, but as soon as I finished taking Intro to Psych, I realized I was really fascinated by social and personality psych. I was really fascinated by the psychology of everyday behavior, which is really what those two fields cover. So that's what got me interested in social psych.
And what made you decide to get a PhD in sociology?
Well, after I finished my master's in psychology, I was looking mostly at psychology PhD programs. There was just one social PhD program that I applied to, and I applied there because, well, there were two reasons I applied. One, there was a professor there named Corey Keyes. He's a sociologist, but he was one of the members of the first cohort of positive psychologists in the summits that Marty Seligman and Chris Peterson organized around the time they created this field of positive psychology. So he was well-versed in the psychological literature. He'd published in psychology journals. He probably published at least as much in psychology journals as in sociology journals. And he was in Atlanta, which is where I lived for 11 years before I started the master. So the bonus was I could move back to the city where I had a lot of friends. And that's why I applied to that one PhD in sociology program. It was really more a matter of convenience, and working with this one advisor was not out of a really deep-seated interest in sociology at the time. It ended up being very fruitful. I learned a lot of things I would not have learned, both in terms of methodology and in terms of content. So it was a worthwhile decision.
I'm curious, what drew you into your research areas?
Well, the research area of happiness, it fascinated me for a couple of reasons. To begin with, I was fascinated by positive psychology, which is the science of functioning well. And the part of positive psych that gets most of the publicity is happiness research, because everyone just likes the idea of being happy for long periods of time, whereas in regular life, you're happy for a few moments here and there, you're sad for a few moments, moods come and go. So it's appealing. It's like sugar. It just really has this immediate appeal. But I became interested in the larger field of positive psychology when I was looking at graduate programs. partly because it was new and I felt like it was a good area to go into because it was new. There were a lot of unanswered questions there. There are definitely other topics in social psychology that have just been researched over and over again for decades, and there's still progress every year, but there's not a whole lot of novelty there. So that was one of the first things that caught my eye. And I applied, so the first time I tried to apply to, well, the first time I did apply to a number of PhD schools, I didn't just apply to people who were studying happiness. So I applied to one person who was studying mindfulness meditation, a few people who were studying self-determination theory, all of which have to do with functioning well. And I ended up actually not studying with Sonia Lyubomirsky, who is sort of the central happiness person. That was the other PhD program I got into, and so that was a tough choice. But in terms of happiness, I think it's just this broad area of research that has to do more with functioning well overall. And most happiness classes have to do with functioning well overall than just a mood or a question of emotion, the question of creating this enduring happiness as an emotion. So it's a good area. It encompasses a lot.
Yeah, so speaking of how happiness is defined and how it's more than kind of an emotion or mood state, I really liked how your class is structured so that students have journal assignments based on the readings, and the first week looks at the definition of happiness. You distinguish between hedonic and eudaimonic. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, types of happiness. Yeah. And can you tell us the main difference between hedonic and eudaimonic types of happiness?
So hedonic happiness is mostly about maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. So it's emotion-centered. If you feel pleasant, if you feel pleasant emotions and you feel generally satisfied rather than dissatisfied, a lot of the time you're high in hedonic happiness, whereas if you feel dissatisfied a lot of the time, if you feel like most of your life is spent dealing with unpleasant emotions, you're low in terms of hedonic happiness. And at every different moment, you have a slightly different mood or emotion, so you can average it across time, or you can just look at a period like a week and say, how happy have I been in general this week? It turns out we do tend to judge events and days by how they end. So if the end of a movie leaves you feeling very happy or you're satisfied with it, you tend to think of the movie as good. Similarly with the day, you do tend to have that bias in terms of how it ends. But it is more fleeting and emotion-centered. Eudaimonic happiness, eudaimonia, is generally translated as flourishing, and it comes from Aristotle's book, The Nicomachean Ethics, which is a treatise on a good life. It's not really a treatise on happiness per se. And his idea was you attain eudaimonia if you fulfill your inner potential. So if you're excellent to the degree that you have the capacity to be excellent at any higher field, so something that puts humans above animals, a field like medicine or philosophy or music, you don't have to be exceptionally talented, but if you fulfill the talents you do have, you have eudaimonic happiness. And nowadays people use eudaimonia as an umbrella for things like meaning in life and purpose in life and good relationships with others as well. So it's more about this evaluation that your life has meaning and has goals, and that you're actualizing your potential to do good and to just lead a full life. And the correlations between hedonic and eudaimonic happiness can sometimes be quite high. So there's a debate about whether they're just two ways of looking at the same thing or not. A few people have tried to parcel them out. It turns out there's some people who are really driven by a mission, and they have to make a lot of sacrifices to fulfill that mission. So they end up not experiencing a lot of hedonic happiness, but they experience a lot of eudaimonic fulfillment. And then there are some people, particularly young people, who maybe have a lot of money, who experience a lot of hedonic happiness just through the pursuit of pleasure, but also feel this inner emptiness. So there are small sets of people who just seem to have one, but in general, they're pretty strongly correlated.
I want to ask you about what the research says on a few factors that people tend to think about when it comes to happiness. So, for example, what do we know about the role of relationships?
Well, one of the things we know pretty consistently is people who feel like they have good social relationships, people who feel like they're not lonely, tend to be happy. There's almost no research out there that has shown cases of people who are very lonely but also very happy. And the number of friends you have obviously varies. You may want just a couple. You may want a large group. So it's not really about the number of friends. It's just whether you feel satisfied by the quality of your relationships. And related to that, people who are married tend to be a little happier. I should qualify by that by saying that people who are in bad marriages are unhappier. So on average, people who have good marriages are happier than people who are not married, but people who are not married are happier than people who are in bad marriages. So marriage is not a solution per se, but having that that solid social relationship is also good for your happiness overall. Beyond that, there's a variety of things that matter. Money is one issue that's often brought up, and it's complicated, but a certain amount of money does seem to be necessary. If you have basic needs, you need those needs fulfilled. So the most basic needs, like hunger and thirst, of course, you need money to fulfill those, to have a place to live. And then beyond that, there are some semi-basic needs as well. So in a society like ours, a television is now a basic need. If you feel like you can't afford that and you want that, you're probably unhappy. Wealthier societies also, up to a point, tend to be happier, probably because basic needs are being fulfilled. Beyond the point of basic need fulfillment, there's a lot of invidious comparison going on. So you might feel unhappy because your neighbor owns a Tesla and you don't, and you're comparing yourself against your neighbor. But at that point, it's more about aspirations, about being the wealthiest or the coolest person. So that's where money gets pretty complicated. Above a certain point, you tend to find that you need a huge increment in terms of a salary increase in order to just get a little happier. So money's another factor. Gratitude is a factor. So if you feel like, if you appreciate the fact that many of the things you idealize have been realized, or many of the things you have in your life are very good, very beautiful, in many ways close to ideal, and you regularly experience that gratitude, you tend to be happy. People who are hopeful tend to be happy. That's almost redundant. People who tend to forgive tend to be happy. So bearing a grudge often just causes a lot of inner pain. And if you look at clinical psych, you can take anything that tends to cause anxiety or depression and invert it, and that usually causes, if not happiness, at least some peace of mind. So having a big gap between who you idealize yourself to be and who you feel like you actually are is associated with anxiety and unhappiness. If you feel there's a smaller gap there, if you feel like you're not deficient in any major way, you tend to be happy too.
That's helpful to hear those things, and they sound really consistent with when we're doing therapy and what the types of things we're focusing on, like you said, in kind of the inverted way. I think that another component that people mention, which I think is connected to the other concepts you talked about, is meaning. And are there particular domains, maybe within some of the ones that you already mentioned, that tend to make for a meaningful life?
Well, we know that people who are searching for meaning tend to be unhappy, and that's because people who are searching for meaning tend to be the people who don't have meaning. And I have not seen any research that shows there are some very effective ways to find meaning. If you look at the issue of commitment, in general you find that if people, either with the help of a therapist or on their own, decide to commit to a value, they can get meaning from that value, but it's unclear, at least I've not read anything in the literature that makes it clear why some people are able to commit and why some people are not. I think when it comes to commitment, some people feel like if they engage in a lot of philosophizing and a lot of thinking, they will eventually get to a point where they're ready to commit, or where they're certain that commitment is worthwhile. And I mean it could be commitment to a person. You could get meaning in life from a marriage or from a good relationship. It could be commitment to a value like humanism or making the world a better place. But when I teach students about this topic, I do mention that in general, philosophizing can generally make you just good at philosophizing, and that's a trap that you have to watch out for. I don't have any literature to support it, but I feel like based on anecdotal evidence, That's a problem. We do tend to know that meaning tends to come from a combination of value and coherence and purpose. So if you feel like there's some temporal endpoint that you're striving towards, you tend to have purpose. That means that if you just have one purpose and you fulfill it, or you have one goal and you fulfill it, you might have a crisis of meaning. So retirement, for example, could create a crisis of meaning. And people who are religious tend to have more meaning in life. And I think that's mainly because religion provides you with a clear sense of ultimate purpose, especially if religion promises something after death. When it comes to coherence and value, so value is a bit like self-esteem. That can often, if you do feel like your life lacks value or you lack value, I think that's an issue where you might want to see a therapist. And in terms of coherence, I think some of that's under your control and some of it's not. So if you are not sure what you want to do in your life and you pursue several different careers, you might feel like your life has been incoherent, whereas maybe if you're fortunate, you have a good mentor early on, you commit to something that you know is right for you, you might feel like your life is more coherent. But again, in those areas, I don't really know if evidence-based strategies where people have said, if you follow this path, you'll definitely find coherence and you'll find value.
Chris, you mentioned a few different times a potential role of therapy for people who are struggling in certain areas with things like happiness. And I like that you have students exposed to different types of therapeutic approaches in your class. For example, they read a chapter from David Byrne's Cognitive Behavioral Therapy self-help book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, and you also have them practice mindfulness. I was wondering how students respond to those assignments.
Sure. So the David Burns reading actually comes from Corey Keyes. He originally designed the syllabus for this class. And so one of the things I kept about 60 to 70% of his syllabus. One of the things I kept was the David Burns chapter. And that goes with another chapter another personality inventory on your tendencies to think dysfunctionally. So whether you tend to be a perfectionist or you tend to overly desire the approval of others. So those two chapters go together. And they really like that. Burns, I think, is an excellent writer. I think that book has sold really well because he explains things very clearly and also comes across as a human being who has struggled with issues himself. So he's relatable in that way. One of the sentences in that book that seems to capture a lot of students is he says something along the lines of, every negative thought that you have is a result of your distorted thinking, which is something I actually don't agree with. So it's a little odd. I don't know how to approach that. But I mean, in class, when I talk about these things, I do say, look, sometimes life really does suck. So if you sit down and you practice a cognitive behavioral strategy, like noticing a negative thought you're having and saying, okay, am I engaging in distorted thinking? There is a chance you'll say, yeah, I am engaging in distorted thinking. I'm engaging in perfectionism. I'm beating myself up because I'm internally saying to myself, I have to be a perfect person, and that's just irrational. People are not perfect. But on the other hand, you might lose an opportunity, and you might sit down and you might think, yeah, actually, that was a sort of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I missed it, and that's a bummer. So that's my I think that's the one drawback with Burns, but I think dealing with it in a lecture is helpful. When it comes to mindfulness, I also get pretty good feedback on that. I mean, sometimes I get exceptionally good feedback. Like in the past couple of semesters, I've had one student at the end of each semester write in the evaluation that mindfulness just helped them immensely. One student said it just helped her sleep a whole lot better than she used to. I also get a couple of students who say they don't quite get the hang of mindfulness. One student said he actually started to feel more anxiety when he was trying to follow this guided meditation. Overall, I think I would like to get more into the science of mindfulness in future classes. I try to focus on the history of it and talk about Buddhism and why in Buddhism craving is considered the root of all suffering and how mindfulness is supposed to help you see clearly. So I talk about the theological roots of Buddhist mindfulness, but I'd like to get more into the science of it. And I also generally recommend Headspace or a similar app. So I ask students to do guided meditations. One of the things I've thought about doing is actually having them do a breathing meditation instead. So just giving them written instructions and having them do a breathing meditation at their own pace. I've been curious, actually, what reactions do you get when you talk to your patients about mindfulness?
I think that the variety that you just described is what I see too. Some people take to it really quickly. Others are frustrated by it. I assigned in my abnormal psychology class to practice some different exercises that could include mindfulness to kind of just get the hang of what I was talking about or learn about concepts more. And there was really the range of people who loved it to people who were neutral to people who said it made them more anxious and they stopped doing it. So I'm curious, and I don't know how much science there is on individual differences on this stuff. I know that just in talking to other therapists that sometimes when individuals have panic disorder and they're prone to panic attacks, sometimes doing mindfulness exercises gets them paying more attention to their bodily sensations and they might be more prone to have that. But yeah, it's quite a range, and I try to talk about it as one tool that, like most things, to give it more than one try, especially with mindfulness, because it can feel frustrating. But I think if you talk about how that's not unusual to feel like you can't focus or you get distracted, that sometimes helps people feel a little bit better.
My experiences are very similar to what you both described. I know when I taught abnormal psychology, I had students take turns leading mindfulness to begin each class. And there was a range of reactions, of course, to leading it because it felt like a presentation, I think, to some of them, which automatically elicits some anxiety. But in reaction to practicing mindfulness as well, I had one student specifically say, I feel a lot more anxious now. You told me this would be good. So definitely have a range. And I've had the same response in clinical work as well, with just different reactions. And I think sometimes it has to do with expectations and how one introduces mindfulness. And even like today, I had a colleague tell me that she facilitated a mindfulness meditation to start a DBT group. And that
a dialectical behavior
yes,
therapy.
Yes, thank you. And that she picked up about something about like 10 minutes long, and that everyone thought that was far, far too long to practice anything related to mindfulness in the group. So, and they very usually do something closer to maybe 3 minutes. So this was a stretch compared to what they were used to. So yeah, I think there's a lot that probably goes into reactions related to experience and expectations and a lot of those individual difference factors.
I like to start with chocolate, mindfulness to chocolate. I feel that that really gets people into
when
it.
When I co-facilitated the DBT group, I did start with that, but I immediately regretted it because there was a couple of individuals who came over from the eating disorder clinic for which chocolate was not something that was good for them. And so right away, I metaphorically had my foot in my mouth because that was the only thing I brought.
Oh, no.
And then I very quickly shifted to, well, if you're not comfortable eating the chocolate, why don't we just focus on looking at it and those? But even that, I think pushing it for some of those people with food. But yes, my instinct is also to go to chocolate right away to a detrimental effect in one instance.
Yeah, so, or music.
Music is a safer bet for sure.
Yeah, I know there's one mindfulness instructor at Georgia Tech who has a semester-long class just on mindfulness who uses chocolate. I actually make brownies for my class at one point of the semester, but it's usually not the week I talk about mindfulness.
Sure.
are brownies associated with happiness in your anecdotal experience?
With fleeting happiness.
That's more the hedonic, clearly.
Yeah.
So one thing that I want to share with our listeners is it's clear that your class has a profound effect on students. And so this is from an evaluation, a few excerpts from an evaluation someone wrote at the end of your class. This was one of the most rewarding classes in terms of personal growth and understanding that I've taken here. My mental health is better than it's been in a year, and although some days are still tough, I'm generally happy now. And more importantly, I know what makes me happy and how to create lasting happiness step by step. Thank you, Dr. Martin, from the bottom of my heart. And it goes on, but I thought I'd capture the main points. What's it like reading feedback like that?
It's really fulfilling. It's actually much more fulfilling than doing research and publishing papers, to be honest, which is kind of a grind. I mean, I really teach this class because I derive meaning in life from teaching it. I actually had a corporate job just before I started teaching at Georgia Tech, and I could have had a higher salary if I'd stayed in the corporate world, but I derive a lot of meaning in life from teaching this course, which is why I do it. And I think it helps me because I think of the person I was when I was in college, and I had a very confusing college experience because I was an international student. So I had to deal with culture shock, and I had to deal with a really intense academic environment because I went to a very competitive college where professors graded pretty harshly. So I feel like I can understand that colleges are not sometimes the best places for your mental health if you're very competitive. And Georgia Tech is a place where students are definitely very competitive. And we get a lot of students who also are kind of on autopilot. They've figured out strategies for doing really well academically in school, and then they almost automatically apply to one of the most competitive colleges, maybe the most competitive in Georgia, because that's sort of what you do if you're roughly interested in science and engineering. And then they get here, but then they start to wonder if they've really just been moving along thoughtlessly and aren't really sure what they want in life, and whether they've never really thought about happiness and meaning in life. So I think this course helps people who are in that phase.
It's an amazing to hear that student feedback and mm-hmm. to hear the satisfaction that you get from it. And I think that ties into one more thing I wanted to talk to about the class. It actually came up in conversation with some friends that I was visiting with last week. You include a video about the happiness trap by the acceptance and commitment clinician Dr. Russ Harris in your class. And mm-hmm. we'll link to this in the show notes. It's a great video. I recommend it to everyone. What made you want to add that to the class?
About 3 years ago, when I was doing research for my dissertation, I was talking to therapists who've had tenures of 20 to 30 years. So therapists who've seen several cohorts of students over 2 to 3 decades at college counseling centers. And one of them, who was at a polytechnic institute, said that he's found ACT helps his students a lot. They tend to be very competitive. And he suggests that they read The Happiness Trap. And I think I'd heard of the book, but I just mentally classified it in this bucket of new self-help books. Didn't know much about it. So it was striking that he said that this book consistently works quite well for students. And I did some research on it. I knew I didn't have the capacity to assign the whole book to students, but I found this video that summarizes the book really well. And the book itself is excellent, I should mention to your listeners. So there's also an illustrated version. If you're a comic book fan or a graphic novel fan, you might like that version better. I've read both, and I personally like the normal version better, the original version. The book really takes ACT, and I don't know if ACT was originally neatly divided into these 6 phases or if that's something that Russ Harris did. I don't have a clinical psych background. But I liked how he created this natural progression of 6 phases. And when you're teaching students about therapy, it's also neat because you can talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, and then you can talk about mindfulness. And especially when you're talking about the initial stages of acceptance and behavioral therapy, part of what you're really talking about is mindfulness, so you can connect it to something you've just talked about. And part of what you're talking about is contrast with cognitive behavioral therapy, because you're saying there's a bit of a contrast there. In cognitive behavioral therapy, you want to engage with the thought and think about how it might be irrational, whereas with the happiness trap, you actually just want to distance yourself from the thought and classify it as a very, very unimportant thought. So in both cases, you're trying to train yourself to react to thoughts in a certain way. So as soon as you have a negative thought, what's the next thing you do? You could pair it with, I'm going to analyze this thought because it's probably irrational, or you can pair it with, this thought's probably just really unimportant, so I'm going to acknowledge that it exists, but that's about it. So I like that, but I like the fact that it's future-oriented. So unlike CBT, which doesn't really talk about commitment to values and doesn't really talk about how orienting your life towards goals after you've solved some problems is also helpful. CBT just doesn't really have a lot to say about the future, whereas ACT does, and I like that as well. I wish I could talk about DBT. I've just never understood DBT well enough to talk about it. In fact, I don't understand it very well at all right now.
There are a lot of clinicians, I think, who feel that way with DBT. Honestly, I had some exposure to it in grad school, but when I really understood it wasn't till I was on internship, because I had a supervisor who had been trained by Marsha Linehan, the creator of dialectical behavior therapy, and she observed me and did co-therapy. And honestly, I think that's what it took to really understand it. But it ties in a lot of the concepts, I would say, that you were just talking about. I think the main thing it seems to add, really, that is different than those things are the specific skills for tolerating distress without acting impulsively. And I do think CBT and ACT kind of get to that, but maybe it emphasizes it even a little bit more. Yeah.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask you about just a couple more things. So stand-up comedy and then also your podcast. So maybe we can start with, can you tell us about how you got into stand-up comedy?
You know, I don't know exactly when I decided to try it out. I was definitely not a person who went out to hear comedians a lot. And then one year, it was 2014, I went to London as a teaching assistant for an Emory program, and there were a lot of comedians doing preview shows in London. They were previews for the Edinburgh Festival, which was happening a couple of months after that. So I heard a lot of comedians in a very short period of time, and I really loved it. And I think that was around the time I thought, I might enjoy doing this too. But I didn't. I came back and, again, didn't go out to comedy for a while. And then one of the principles I teach students about in my happiness class is that it's more fruitful to spend money on experiences than things. So when I started dating Erin, who's now my wife, our first Christmas together, one of my presents to her was tickets to a comedy show. Emo Phillips was the comedian. And we really loved that show. And again, I started to think, maybe I should try this out. And then at some point during my dissertation, when I was just writing my dissertation, I thought, it's pretty depressing to just sit at home all day working on this and then sit at home at night too. So I need to get out and do something. One of my hobbies was playing the piano, but that's a pretty solitary hobby. So I thought, well, why not just try this thing and see how it goes? So I went to a few open mic shows. Fortunately, there's a ton of them here in Atlanta, so it's not that hard to get time on an open mic show. I wrote some jokes. I was pretty cautious. I guess I took a somewhat academic approach of drafting jokes and revising them and just being sure I was ready to submit before I submitted. So I worked on these jokes. The jokes that I felt most confident about, I put first and last so I would start and end with a good laugh. And I went up one night and I did it. And it was a night that was pretty well attended. So there was an audience actually paying attention. One of the downsides of open mic comedy is sometimes there are only five people there. So luckily that experience went well, and then I just kept doing it for a while, and I got some spots at the open mic show at the Laughing Skull, which is a pretty big show here, and those went well, and I got a couple of spots at the Greenville Comedy Festival in Greenville, South Carolina. So I travel there once a year as well. It's a fun thing to do. I mean, it's really fulfilling to make people laugh. It's kind of like magic. It's kind of the delight you get from watching magic. There's an element of mystery there. You don't know if your joke is going to land, and often it does, and it just feels amazing. So I like that. And there's also enough challenge that it's not boring. So like any art form, I guess it's challenging to do well so you don't get bored.
That's so cool to hear, because I would think it would be terrifying to try to do stand-up. And I mean, you hear even really great comedians talk about times when it fell flat. So even getting the courage to go up and do open mic, that seems like, I don't know, that takes a lot of bravery. But then, yeah, I could see how that would be incredible. It's really great to make people laugh. So that's really cool to hear.
Yeah, I've heard of actors who think that stand-up comedy is terrifying, whereas I feel the opposite. I would be terrified of being a theater or a stage, sure. I mean, a stage or or Screen Actor. Going up for your first time it's pretty scary, I would say. But it's kind of like lecturing. I mean, if you are a college lecturer, the very first time you do it, it's pretty scary.
Right.
That's true. And most of the laughs I got were accidental slapstick from dropping things and tech issues. Right. Yeah. No, it was these were not planned, written, revised jokes. They like those, or if you accidentally slip up or something. But that was at least that was my experience teaching. Later on, I got a better sense of their sense of humor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I couldn't turn on the PowerPoint projector at one point, and I was just like a year older than a lot of my students, and they're just like, "What's going on?" Like, we get this with some of the older professors, but you're like our age, and I was like, "I get it, but it happens when you're up here, I guess." I don't know.
That's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're right. You do. It's amazing what one can habituate to with repeated exposure, and then enjoy.
I mean, it's. There's just an element of unpredictability. I mean, sometimes you can get on stage right after someone who got really angry at a heckler in the audience, and the whole audience is a little scared and not interested in laughing, so you have those experiences. You have experiences where the person before you was great, they got the energy level up, so it was perfect. It's unpredictable. In that sense, it's different from lecturing, because a lot of it's contextual.
Who are some of your favorite comedians?
I really like Emo Phillips, and I really like Mike Kaplan. He spells his first name M-Y-Q. His humor is a little academic, I would say. I think academics would really enjoy him more than other people. I'd say those two are my absolute favorites. I also really like John Mulaney.
Yes.
I think he's really good at what he does. Yeah, and I recently discovered Kyle Kinane. So Netflix has this show called The Stand-Ups, and it's really half-hour-long specials instead of hour-long specials. Every episode is just a half-hour of a comedian doing stand-up. So it's really not a show, but they've released it in seasons with six episodes each, and I discovered Kyle Kinane, who's really good. So if you have Netflix, which I think the whole universe has at this point, you should check him out.
Yeah, I'll definitely check him out. That sounds great.
So maybe just to finish up, could you tell our listeners a little bit about the focus of your podcast?
Sure. My podcast is called Half Hour of Heterodoxy, and thanks to the name, I feel like I have to limit episodes to 30 minutes each, which is kind of a nice constraint to work under. I've done a few special one-hour ones, but it's affiliated with Heterodox Academy, and the mission of Heterodox Academy is to help universities teach students to be open to different ideologies and, or at least be respectful towards people who have different ideologies, who come from different cultures, who have different religions, to have students develop the sense of tolerance and develop confidence in debate rather than feeling fearful as well. And these issues are complicated because politics is a complicated domain, but that's largely our mission. And so Heterodox, the podcast, Half Hour of Heterodoxy, I'd say has some guests who have done some really groundbreaking work in teaching students to be, to understand other cultures better, to understand different political ideologies better. So recently we had Maria Dixon Hall, who's created this really innovative program of cultural intelligence at Southern Methodist University, which deals with cultures both within the U.S. and international cultures and helping people understand different cultural values. Then I do interviews with guests who've done some really groundbreaking work in moral psychology or political psychology, work that helps us understand why people differ in terms of their morality. And then there's sort of this miscellaneous grab bag of people who've just done unorthodox work. So whether it's really people in any of the social sciences who've done work that qualifies as unorthodox in some way, I tend to invite them on the podcast as well.
One of the episodes I really liked was with the historian Kevin Cruz. I thought that was great. Do you have other favorites you might recommend for people who would be new to your podcast?
Well, you've been on the podcast. I'd recommend that episode.
Well, thank you.
That's the 2019 episode.
Which I enjoyed very much. Thanks for having me on.
sure, thanks. Thanks for being on. I think it really depends on what you're interested in. And you can, if you skim our titles, you can see what each episode is about. I mean, I think I like the episode with Arthur Sakamoto. So I'm Asian American and he's Asian American. And a lot of his work has to do with how conventional scholarship about Asian American tries to perpetuate this paradigm that's actually wrong. And I tend to agree with him. So I really like the episodes I've done with him. And I've done 3 episodes with him now. He's been on the show a lot. I did an episode with John Haidt and Greg Lukianoff around the time The Coddling of the American Mind came out. And I think that episode turned out really well. Like you mentioned, the Kevin Cruz episode is really good. Julian Zelizer, who is the co-author of the book that I talked to Kevin Cruz about. In fact, Julian's the first author. I think the episode I did with him turned out pretty well as well. But really, I'd say look through the titles and based on a title, pick an episode that seems interesting to you.
Okay, that's great. We'll make sure to link to that in the show notes. And I will also recommend that our listeners follow Chris on Twitter. He tweets out a lot of interesting thoughts and a variety of topics. He's at ChrisMartin76, ChrisMartin76, and we'll link to it. And Chris, are there any take-home messages or closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap up?
I would say that when it comes to happiness, since that's what we started talking about, I think all listeners should be aware that it's still a developing field, so the amount of stuff we don't know about happiness is still a lot. It's a lot larger than what we do know about happiness. So if you're curious about happiness research, I think one thing you want to watch out for is self-help gurus who claim they have the single definitive answer to happiness. I think one thing to cultivate is curiosity about what researchers are going to discover as years go by.
Thank you so much for your time, Chris. This was an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Jedi Council Podcast, a member of the Geek Therapy Podcast Network. You can find more information about our podcast or blog at www.jedi-council.com. If you would like to support the Jedi Council Podcast, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/Jedi Council. The views expressed on this podcast are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. Additionally, this podcast is for entertainment and informational purposes only and should not be used in place of advice from a mental health or medical professional. If you're struggling with mental health issues, please seek professional help.